This is the BBC.
Welcome to Everyday Ethics, our weekly ethical download from the BBC with me, Audrey Carvel. On this week's podcast, three conflicts, 200 victim interviews and 6 years of intense research. Professor John Brewer on the mechanics of building the peace. Now, we often talk here about how victims and survivors of the Troubles have been ignored, let down or failed. Well, now one of Northern Ireland's leading academics say they have a vital contribution to make. They are experts, he says, at peace building and should be fully involved in that process. Professor John Brewer is head of the George Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security and Justice at Queen's University. He and his team of researchers have just completed two books on how victims of political violence respond to their trauma and how they engage in everyday peace building. They focused on conflicts here, South Africa and Sri Lanka. I asked Professor Brewer, was each one of these peace processes unique?
Yes, they are. Northern Ireland represents in some way the epitome of a peace process where people give up their first preference for a second preference mutually agreed deal. Of course, in Northern Ireland, that deal was called the Good Friday Agreement. Now, in Sri Lanka, the peace process is quite different. It's what we might call a victor's peace, in which one group is militarily vanquished and defeated. South Africa, the situation is different again. South Africa's is an essentially colonial model in which the elite changes. It changes its racial origins, it changes its nationality, its language. But very little changes at the bottom. Now, what we were interested in was the impact of these different kinds of peace processes on victims' capacity to compromise and to reconcile after conflict.
And you say, John, that the victims have an absent presence in peace. What do you mean by that?
Well, indeed, it's this absent presence that motivated the research in the first place. I think that we are aware in Northern Ireland of this absent presence, but it applies also in post-apartheid South Africa and post-massacre Sri Lanka. What I mean by it is that victims have a presence in that they are talked about aplenty. They're talked about by politicians, they're talked about in the media, they're talked about by victim support group leaders, and they're talked about in popular culture. But they have an absence because they're rarely heard directly. They're spoken on behalf of by these others. So we rarely get to hear victims directly. Or at least what we don't hear is the vast majority of victims beyond those few that the media and politicians routinely invoke for their own ends and purposes. So the research was primarily about trying to give voice to what we consider to be voiceless victims, so that they could be heard from directly.
You say that you examine a whole array of social processes by which the victim category is sociologically constructed, essentially determining who is and who is not a victim. And many of these victims, some of the victims, you say, are canonized, most of the others are neglected. How does that happen?
I think it's fairly clear from Northern Ireland that the victim category is contested. Who is a victim and who is not a victim is a matter of extreme political debate and contestation. Now, this also applies in South Africa and Sri Lanka. So we argue that what constitutes the victim category is actually socially constructed. It's constructed by media stereotypes as to who constitutes a victim or not. It's constructed by politicians as to who they consider to be the right or the wrong victim. And it's constructed by the media. All sorts of media processes determine who it is that they recognise as a victim and who they give voice to. Now, the result of these social processes is that some victims are heard from a great deal, but most other victims are not heard from at all. And one other sad consequence is that we tend to develop what we call a victim's hierarchy, in which victims from one's own group are said to have suffered the most, and it's victims from the other group who were supposedly not innocent, supposed to have been perpetrated the most heinous of crimes. So what we were interested in this research was, what do victims themselves consider the victim category to be? Who do they consider victims to be? And it's in that context that I think that I am arguing that the majority of victims, not all, and I'll come back to the exception, but the majority of victims constitute what I call moral beacons.
Well, I was interested in that. You say that the response to their victimhood of most of the first generation victims in all three conflict zones that you picked was a moral response. Now, how did that manifest itself?
I have to say that this took us by surprise. I should add at this point that this research is based on over 200 interviews with victims who we accessed through a whole series of different routes in order to get a cross-section and comprehensive account of victim experiences. And it's based upon two statistical surveys of the adult population, one in Northern Ireland and one in Sri Lanka. So it is firmly based in the evidence. And what took us by surprise, in fact, was that most victims responded to their victimhood experience in a moral way. Clearly, they would have preferred not to have been victimized. But given their victimhood experience, they developed what I call a minimum moral consensus that says, this must never happen again. My children and my grandchildren must not go through what I went through. Now, that minimum moral consensus tended to encourage the majority of victims to develop a wish to get along together after conflict. This notion of getting along together was said time and time again. It's almost as if they were seeking to restore a sense of sociability after conflict in order that their children and grandchildren must not go through what they went through. Now, the consequence of this moral response was for them to engage in considerable cross-community interaction. Many victims talked about how they never knew someone of the other sort, whether they be white, Sinhalese, Protestant or Catholic, but that as a consequence of their victimhood, they have deliberately engaged in cross-community engagement because they believe that it's in getting along together that the future will be better than the past.
And those who weren't moral beacons, what did they do?
There are a small number of victims in all three societies who are stuck in what we call a victim identity. It's as if their life was frozen in the moment of their victimhood. They have not moved on from that victimhood. They tend to explain all of life's subsequent travails, the normal travails that happen to everyone. They tend to explain all these subsequent travails on their victimhood experience. And what this tends to mean is that they tend to be socially withdrawn. They tend not to mix, or at least to mix only with people of their own kind. So they tend to mix predominantly with people in their own victim support group or people just like themselves. This tends not to be interracial or interethnic or cross-community kind of engagement. And we believe that developing a victim identity rather than a survivor identity freezes them and thus tends to inhibit their capacity to respond to their victimhood in a positively moral way.
You also argue, John, that many of these victims should be mainstreamed, essentially, made central to peace building, that they have a capacity there for peace building that many others who are charged with making peace do not have. What do you believe they can contribute?
I think that that they should be mainstreamed, made central to a peace process rather than sidestreamed, marginalised and be seen as problems. They should be mainstreamed for two reasons. First, morally, they constitute moral beacons. They tend to shed a light to the rest of us in terms of their capacity for emotional empathy with the other, in their capacity for forgiveness and reconciliation. Now, this is not to say that these people find reconciliation and forgiveness easy. It is not. But despite its difficulties, despite its costs to them, they persist with trying to respond to their victimhood in a moral way. But there's another sense in which I think they can be everyday peace builders. And that is that their capacity for reconciliation, forgiveness, for developing links with the other, their capacity for emotional empathy results in what I call everyday acts of peace building. And all too often, we tend to see peace building as very large, macro-scale, top-down initiatives done by somebody else, done by professionals, done by people who are trained in conflict resolution, or done by politicians. I believe very, very strongly that peace processes are too important to be left to politicians and to professionals. Peace building has to be seen as a skill which each one of us possesses. And it struck me when we were doing this research on victims that victims exemplify what I call everyday life peace building, the capacity to for small gestures of reconciliation, the kind word, the handshake, the acknowledgement of suffering, the calling up of hate speech, the speaking out against of stereotypes that demonize the other. These small gestures, done in school, done in the playground, done over garden fences, done in the supermarket, done in church, these small gestures of peace building, I think, allow us to grow peace from the bottom up. Now, what this requires us to do, I think, is to see that the skills for peace building are possessed by everyone. You don't have to be trained in conflict resolution. You don't have to be a professional peace builder in the UN to show these small, everyday gestures that demonstrate emotional empathy with the other, that demonstrate forgiveness, that demonstrate the wish for reconciliation.
Empathy being at the heart of so much of everything in life. Were you able, John, as an academic, to have empathy with a victim?
I think that one of the most defining characteristics of my life is the fact that my father was killed when I was 2. I know what it's like to have a big hole in the middle of your chest called love that you simply cannot fill, no matter how hard you try. And I think that my life as a sociologist has been dominated by the search for social justice that is rooted in that biographical experience of losing a father when you're 2 years of age. This capacity for justice, this capacity for emotional empathy, enables me very much to identify with the victim narratives that we heard. Now, imagine listening to over 200 victim narratives. It can be emotionally taxing, it's emotionally draining. But I think that my capacity to empathize with the victim's narratives, my capacity to see in the victim the same resolution that I had, not to be a prisoner of that victimhood, I think it has given me an unusual perception into the experiences of victims in Northern Ireland, South Africa, and Sri Lanka. Now, I should say that this research took 6 years. It wasn't a fly-by-night, helicopter in and helicopter out kind of research. It took 6 years. Many of the interviews were 2 or 3 hours. When you delve that deeply into people's lives, You can't but help emotionally empathise with them.
The capacity for empathy. Profound words there by Professor John Brewer. He's head of the George Mitchell Institute at Queen's University. He and his team have just completed two books. I'll give you the names of the two books. The Sociology of Compromise After Conflict and The Sociology of Everyday Life Peace Building. And they're both published by Palgrave and they're out now. That was Professor John Brewer. Thanks to John for taking part in that interview. You've been listening to Everyday Ethics from the BBC with me, Audrey Carvel. There are more details on the BBC website.